I enjoy getting to meet with CEOs that I serve on a weekly basis. Those meetings are energizing, and we both walk away with ideas and more confidence for work that needs to be done. As a financial leader, there may be some of you not meeting regularly with your CEO. I highly recommend you make that a priority. And since I do enjoy visiting with CEOs, I reached out to the co-founder of Planet Subaru, based in Boston, to talk about his new book. His name is Jeff Morrill. His book is Profit Wise. And by the way, I am Mark Gandy. This is CFO Bookshelf. Our interview with Jeff Morrill is coming up next. Jeff Morrill, again, he's a new author. His book is Profit Wise, which came out about 2 months ago. And I wanted to know how this book came to be because writing a book, well, it's very time consuming.
My dad was a teacher. And I always admired him for committing to grow new citizens, educated citizens, as they put on some age. And I was influenced by him, just the impact I would see students, you know, visit us many years later after leaving his classes. I'd see the letters come in and I was like, wow, that's really cool. And I think in my career, I've had the opportunity to be an educator. Early on, I didn't know very much, but I had a lot of enthusiasm and passion, and I tried to introduce my team members to that and help them develop their skills, because I knew that if they could do that, then they would help me build a business. It would also help them improve their career prospects over a lifetime and improve their income, their ability to provide for their families. So that was a big part of it. The proximal cause, the inciting incident of writing the book, I was involved in a terrible mountain bike accident where it was very violent. My leg was almost entirely separated from my body when I hit the ground, and what was holding it on was skin and muscle, which is bad enough, except I was all alone in the wilderness at this time. And it was probably inadvisable that I was out riding under those icy conditions by myself, but I've always probably had a slightly unhealthy risk appetite. And when it first happened, I was like, oh, this is going to ruin my day. And within a few moments, I was like, wow, if I don't start making good decisions here, this could be my last day. Fortunately, I'm sitting here today, so you know it turned out well. But I was incapacitated for months after that. So I had a lot of time sitting on a couch with my wife taking care of my every need, including bringing food to me. And I had a lot of time, and I didn't want to blow that opportunity. You know, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. So I was like, here's my chance. I may never get it again. So let's spend this time committing to paper all the wisdom that I learned the hard way in most cases over 20 years of starting with a car business and then building other businesses related to it.
One of the first questions I want to ask you is, based on the first, second chapter, is what is your current reality? Why does it matter? And is there a gap? Now, that's really three questions, but I'm calling it one.
Well, let's talk first, for those of your listeners who haven't had a chance to read the book yet, about the chapter. It's called Defining Reality. And it's a term borrowed from former Herman Miller CEO Max Dupree. And he talked about how important it was before you did anything else, before you started talking about strategy or marketing or even hiring who was going to be doing the work. He wanted to make sure that you had very thoroughly thought through what the whole point of your exercise was. And once you understood that, what you were trying to achieve, what values you wanted to include in that effort, what kind of people you thought wouldn't be needed to do that. Would they be humble people? Would they be aggressive people? Would they be conscientious people? You had to work through all those things before you began. And if you did that, it would increase your chances of success, and it would tend to give a structure for all the success to hang itself on. So in my case, let me talk about the reality that I defined and later would come to define with other members of the team, because reality does evolve in a company. And in my case, we started, our first business was a bankrupt Subaru dealership, and we wanted to differentiate ourselves from the competition, not only in terms of marketing and how we could stand out in the crowd, but more importantly to us, how we could live out our own values through this business. And we knew that the car industry is not known for ethical sales practices, but
right.
But we were raised in the family, my brother, co-founder, and I, we wanted that to be part of our lives. And we knew we could figure out one way or another as young men to eventually earn a good living and make money, but that wasn't going to be good enough. We wanted to do it the right way. So we thought that the notion of the undealership, the alternative to the typical dealership, was a nice way to summarize that reality. And there are a lot of parts to it. That's just a slogan or a term that captures the essence, but there's more to it. One of the things that's important to us about that reality is minimizing our environmental footprint. So we sell vehicles that burn fossil fuels and generate carbon. And that's until we can figure out a way with electric vehicles and other options to reduce that impact. We still have an opportunity in our daily business operations to, for instance, install solar panels on our facilities and do those kinds of things, which we do. So that's how the reality ends up being executed on down the line once you figure it out. As far as the business goes, I think that probably captures it. I think your question is more, I'm not sure I understand the question exactly, but let's dig into it. More like, what's my personal reality, I think, is the way I'm hearing it. Because I think the business reality is pretty much dialed in.
Yes.
As I described it. But I'd say my personal reality, if to use the metaphor of the undealership, the business context, my personal context, I would state it as I want to make sure I live my life in a way that honors the trust that people have in me and depend on me to do the things that they know I need to do. So that's very general, but let me make that specific. So we have people in our businesses that depend on us to make good decisions. And we've been offered, for instance, because of all the money slosh around the economy over the last few years, we've been offered enormous sums for our businesses just to sell them. And in some ways there's a financial appeal to doing that, but so many of the people that are still on our teams, they help me and my brother build the businesses. We have several people, probably 9 or 10 people, who were with us on day one in 1998. And the thought of turning those people over to someone else's stewardship is just beyond me. And I know that life will eventually force me to do that, but I don't have to do that now. Like, I can do that when I'm no longer able to manage the businesses or I'm deprived of my life to do that. And even then, with good decision making, we can make sure that the values that founded the company and value those people on our team can live on to the future and even survive my death. So that's something I'm thinking about. As far as the gap between that stated objective, that high-minded ideal and my ability to perform it, I'd say I'll identify the gap. The gap right now is that I don't think I'm doing enough with the resources I have available. I think I've got to that point. I'm 49, so I don't have quite the energy that I used to have, but I still have some, and I'm a lot smarter than I used to be. I've learned a lot of things the hard way, and I'm able to implement things more successfully and wisely than I could. And I'm casting about, I'm searching at this time in my life for that next thing. The thing we didn't discuss that often comes up is all of our businesses are in Boston. I live in Charlottesville, Virginia now. And I was a refugee from my own businesses. We can go into it later, but I burned out. And after about 20 years of working 6 and 7 days a week, too hard for too long, I just couldn't do it anymore. And for my own physical health and for the sake of my marriage, we decided that the best way was to actually remove myself from that situation. So I've forced myself to enter a new phase in my life, and I haven't figured out quite how to satisfy that desire to make sure I'm living up to the trust and the expectations and the potential that I have to serve others.
That leads to my next question. It's a great segue. I notice in the book, you read a ton, lots of quotes, references to other books. And then, of course, you have the personal board of advisors. So those two things, the fact that you read a lot, I mean, you keep that mind exercise. And again, having that personal board of advisors, I think that's brilliant. And I don't know if you figured that out on your own. It was maybe getting that first advisor, What came first? Did you always have a love for reading? Did you always have a love for wanting to learn and improve?
As I get older, my attention span isn't what it used to be, and my vision is not what it used to be. So I don't read as much as I used to, and I can't plow through a book like I used to. I prefer really interacting with people and learning from people. And I've seen when I was a younger man, I used to make decisions. I had a very unsophisticated notion of what decisiveness was. I thought decisiveness was like, well, you look at something and you make a decision. Well, that's simplistic. And over time, I realized that the quality of my decisions improved a lot when I solicited more information from people, more perspectives, and depending on the situation, didn't even make the decision myself. So in the business context, as time has gone on now, I used to be more of a quarterback in the day-to-day operations of the business, and now I'm more like a coach standing on the sidelines. So there are many decisions I don't make. I just try to make sure that we create an environment where the people who know how to make those decisions the best have the tools, the training, the information, the access to the resources they need to make the good decisions. And then I just facilitate. And as long as I don't see them doing something that is in violation of that undoership reality that I talked about, or in some way set up a situation that might conflict with our values as a company, I'm willing to even go along with decisions that wouldn't exactly be the same ones that I was willing to make, on the notion that there are often multiple paths to the same destination, and that my team might have a better way of doing something. Or maybe it's not even better, it's just different. So anyway, long story short, I think the willingness to incorporate the opinions of others and to learn from the wisdom that other people have learned the hard way is definitely the right way to go.
Let's talk about hiring real quickly. You have a whole chapter just on picking the right people, you know, getting people with a character and skills. But I wanted to maybe even back up a little bit. Why, in your opinion, do business owners hire so quickly? They rush the process. And then what happens, Jeff, is they make a mistake, but then they go through the process again. They rush it. What's your opinion on that?
So they haven't philosophically worked through the importance of it. They haven't arrived at that point where they know this is really a premium priced activity in a business that it deserves all the attention. I think the second thing too is that so many business owners are so busy fighting off alligators that they don't take time to drain the swamp. You know, they spend 3 hours a day taking complaint phone calls from customers, and they just can't seem to find the time and the day to bring aboard a team that could create systems and processes that you never got the complaints in the first place. And I've certainly been there, and I'm very sympathetic that there are so many activities and tasks and responsibilities for business owners. And we have to be very good at wearing a lot of different hats, particularly early on when we don't have the cash flow to hire specific people to do those things. But at some point, if you don't get ahead of that, then your business will always be limited and will suffer from your inability to hire well. And let me just finish by one quote, which might capture the attention of your listeners. And that is, I think for too many years, I was looking for people who looked good in uniform instead of soldiers. Or another way to phrase that in less martial terms might be, I was looking for people who looked good in flight suits instead of pilots. And what I mean is that our interview process, until we refined it through many errors, we learned it the hard way and developed it the hard way, was better at picking up on interview skills than it was on people who could do the job. And later, I mean, recently, there's an incident that I recall. We hired a technician. It was probably the worst interview I'd ever seen anyone give. I mean, it was terrible. But she was applying to be a technician. And it was clear to me, this was a few years ago and I'd had enough experience, that the interview process would last a few days and she would never need those skills again. she was just going to put her head down and come in and turn wrenches and fix cars. And she got along great with people. And I think that's the, that was, I don't know that I would have been capable of doing that earlier in my business career, but as the years went on, I realized that the distinction.
I view business very simply: finding, getting, and doing. Just those three. Finding, getting, doing. Finding is marketing. Getting is selling. Doing is the magic of what happens after selling or getting. However, and I'm glad you brought up a chapter about marketing in the book, I view marketing as something that a lot of owners, they just don't get it. Or they see it as all these crazy tactics, social media, or doing this or that. But I could tell that you get it in terms of marketing, especially in defining that reality. Why? How long did it take you to what I, again, call get it in terms of marketing?
I think the key question that a business owner should ask him or herself is, what story am I telling? And does it resonate with the people that I want to attract in my business? I guess that's a couple of questions. But I don't know that I could have stated it that clearly earlier in my life. So to address your question directly, when we opened up, we just, market research was anecdotal. People don't like the process of buying a car. Dealerships don't have a good reputation. What can we do that's better than that? We'll just do the opposite. You know, and I don't know that we understood the nuances of that about telling a story, but let me give you an example of how we do that. You can't hit customers over the head with the benefits of doing business with you. It's like trying to convince someone that you're funny by telling them that you're funny. It doesn't work that way. The way someone thinks you're funny is you tell a joke and then they laugh and they figure it out on their own. So we don't go that far out of our way talking about customer service. We don't even talk that much about our environmental, our green business practices. But what we do is, I'll give you an example. We have goats that do landscaping at our dealership. They eat the poison ivy. They do our fall cleanups. And so we just tell that story. Like, we have images. So we have video on our website of the goats eating these, eating the vegetation. And we figure that people are smart enough to figure out that we don't have to tell them, look at us, we're green. That they'll divine from the story that we're telling. It's an authentic story. We're not making this up. I mean, it's the true stuff we actually do. It's just like the solar panels on the roof of our building that have we have a kiosk in our showroom that shows the power that's being generated at every moment. And we don't hit people over the head. We let them figure it out. And for other small and medium-sized business owners, I would pose this question directly to them. If someone visits your website, Can a prospect relatively quickly find out why they should do business with you instead of somebody else? If you're a plumber, for instance, it's a pretty hard business to differentiate. But if you just go to your website and you have your business hours and your phone number and, you know, we're registered with the Better Business Bureau, I mean, that's good. I mean, at least you have a website, but what is the thing that differentiates your business? Maybe you figured out a way that every incoming call to your business actually gets answered, which is one of the biggest complaints about plumbers, is that you get an answering machine, you leave a message, and they never call you back, or some other competitive advantage that you're able to share through your website. So I think to the extent that you can think about marketing from the customer's point of view, the better off you're going to be.
I do a lot of work in mergers and acquisitions. I've done my fair share of negotiating. Even in my practice, I have what's called a close rate, very, very high. I never heard of the term BATNA. So I'm assuming if you're in a discussion with a bunch of fellow CEOs, maybe you're speaking to some CFOs or whomever, and negotiating is the topic, I bet the term BATNA is going to come up. Could you tell us what BATNA is?
Sure. And it's not my term, but it's the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. And it's a concept that you need to understand as part of your preparation for a negotiation. And I do recommend preparing for a negotiation, particularly if the stakes are high. And it's a fancy acronym to describe what happens if you can't work something out with somebody? So if you use the example of being mugged in an alley, so if the mugger is asking you for your wallet and you're going to prefer not to give him your wallet, but the question you have to ask is, if we can't work this out, if some discussion isn't going to solve this, then what are my options here? And if you're a trained martial arts expert, then that might be in your option set. You might say that might be the better alternative. Or if you're a very accomplished marksman or markswoman and you have your handgun with you, that might be an option. Neither of those would I be willing to take on, even if I had either set of those skills, because I'd probably just say, you know what, for the money in my wallet and the hassle of replacing the credit cards and my license, I'm just going to give the wallet. But if you don't understand what you stand to lose, it's just hard to work through a negotiation very clearly. And I think sometimes people are so afraid of not working out a deal that they end up doing something that isn't in their best interest. And I hear about people doing this in car showrooms, not in ours, but the typical car showroom where a customer will fixate on a car that they found on the internet and they just really, really want that car. And they'll end up suffering a terrible experience at the dealership and maybe paying too much or accepting less than their trade's worth or all the ways that people can be taken advantage of it at a typical dealership that doesn't care about customers. And they don't realize that they do have another option, which is they could just leave and go find another car. Like, but their unwillingness to think through and really understand all of their options leads them to do something that really isn't in their best interest.
You introduced Chapter 8 with Jeff Bezos, his discussion in his 2015 annual report, Type 1 and Type 2 decisions. I'll let you share what the Type 1, Type 2 decisions are and why did that make the book?
So Type 1 decisions, according to Jeff Bezos, not Jeff Morrill in this case, are those that once they're made, they're difficult to reverse. So I think the classic, he didn't use this example, but my favorite example of the type one decision is who you marry.
All right.
Because once you do that, you've taken on some really serious legal and emotional bonds and responsibilities to that other person. But let's use the example of, in the context of a business, the color that you decide to paint your break room. You know, and if you really screw it up, and you can imagine someone really screwing up painting it like goth black or something, yeah, I mean, it's a few $100 probably to repaint it, but no big deal. And his idea is that the type two decisions should really be pushed pretty far down in the hierarchical chain in the company so that senior level people aren't spending a lot of time picking the color of the paint in the break room, because 99 times out of 100, someone in the organization can get the color close enough to good enough that it's going to be fine. And if it's a total disaster, like I said, the goth intern ends up painting it black, you can repaint it with minimal cost. And if you don't distinguish those two types of decisions, then you subject your company to many risks. I mentioned one earlier. One of the risks is that your senior level people spend way too much time and effort on stuff that they don't have time to be jacking around with. And the other mistake, it's the reverse of it, that you have people who really aren't qualified to be making senior level decisions because you haven't decided who's in charge of the type two decisions, the less significant, more reversible decisions. You haven't decided who's in charge of those and who's in charge of the ones that are really hard to unwind. So in the case of Enron, you know, the textbook example of a company gone amok, there were mid-level executives in that company with way too much authority and power to be making these type one decisions, and they weren't being supervised. And the whole beauty of the type one decision is that when you recognize it, you devote the amount, when you do recognize it for what it is, that it's a difficult to reverse decision. That's going to make sure you devote sufficient resource. Maybe you gather a little bit more data. Maybe you involve a few more relevant stakeholders. Maybe you spend a little bit more time on that. And it's so important for executives and business owners to be understanding at every case, is this a type one or a type two decision, so that you know how much to invest.
In the same chapter, you also mentioned data. Now, I'm a data-driven person, but I agree with you when you say there's this big fetish of maybe relying on too much data. I completely get it. Question I have for you, Jeff, is have you ever made a decision going against the grain, going against the data, and then being right in doing so?
Yeah, I think the problem with data sometimes gives you a false set of confidence that the numbers point the way to the decision. But there's that great maxim that you can drown in information but starve for insight. And the example that comes to mind is that a surprisingly large number of people who go into a hospital end up dying. And if you don't really understand what you're looking at, you could draw the wrong conclusion from that, which is if I'm injured, the last place I want to go to is a hospital because a lot of people die in a hospital, when actually it's the place you most want to go. And so it's important that we understand that data alone only inform insight, and they can confuse us. And the example that I like to use, we had a woman on our team. She was with us about 10 years.
Great story.
Recently left, and I cried when she left because she's the kind of person we like to hire to retire. And generally, as I told you before, in our company, we have almost 10 people from the first year we open, and we do a really good job of hanging on to people. But life circumstances intervene, and she met a man who lived in Kentucky. And so we lost her, not to another car dealership or to a sales opportunity related to her career, but we lost her to love, which might be the best reason to quit. But anyway, we lost her. But long story short, and the focus of the story is that, so she was with us about 10 years and she never sold a lot of cars. You know, our average salesperson might sell, I don't know, 18 cars a month, something like that. And she was always 8, 10, 12. And in the typical dealership, they love to fire people like that because it's like, well, wow, we can't handle this low performer. But what you couldn't see because it was an intangible, it wasn't easily captured in the data, is that her customers loved her. And so many people came in years after she sold them a car, whether it was for repeat customers or it was family members or it was neighbors, because she had a nice social network outside of work, that other salespeople would sell. So in other words, the data set that we had was not capturing the whole picture, as data sets rarely can. And in her case, she was selling directly 10 or 12 cars a month, but indirectly, because of all the business she brought in to her fellow salespeople, there was another 5 or 10 or 15 sales per month. And there is an annuity value to that. She's now gone, but those people are still coming back. And of course, she isn't there, but they had such a good experience 1, 2, 3, 5, 6 times with previous purchases, that they have enough trust for the institution that they're willing, like, okay, well, if Lori's not here, I'd really like to deal with Lori, but I had a good enough experience here the last time and I like the environment. I'll give another salesperson a try. And so it works, it gives that customer a comfort level.
One more thing in chapter 8 before we move on. And by the way, I hope we're not taking up too much of your time, Jeff. You mentioned satisficers versus maximizers. I hate to say this, but I am a maximizer. I think you're a satisficer. What are those terms? What do they mean?
So the Professor Barry Schwartz, in his book about the dangers of choice, even the tyrannies of choice.
Yes.
He distinguished two kinds of people, and the maximizer is the person who is never quite satisfied, always wants more information. This is the person who has a difficult time making decision. And it's, he argues that it's related to a psychological condition that they hate the feeling of knowing that they made a mistake so much that they invest a ton of effort in trying to prevent that mistake in the future. So that's the person at the extreme who gets completely consumed with analysis paralysis. The satisficer, on the other hand, is the person who's like, eh, that's good enough. And that's the person who stands in the toothpaste aisle in front of 100 different kinds of toothpaste and says, well, I need a bigger tube rather than a smaller tube, and just grabs the first one he or she finds. The maximizer, that's going to be the person who says, might even be on his or her phone saying, oh, well, I'm not sure about this ingredient in this antibacterial toothpaste. I heard that's probably not such a good ingredient for my health or for the health of the planet. So let me just look this up on my phone and make sure that they've improved this ingredient, or maybe I should avoid it altogether. That's the maximizer. The reason I introduced it in the book in the context of decisions is it's so important for you to understand what type you are. Because if you're a maximizer, it's okay. And there are a lot of benefits to that. What it means is that you're going to thoroughly vet decisions. You're going to make good ones. But if it's picking a tube of toothpaste, you probably don't have the time. It relates to the previous discussion about Bezos's type 1 and type 2 decisions. You got to know, should I invest the effort? But the risk of being a satisficer, what you need to be looking out for is that you just do things to get them off your plate. So I'll give you an example. If you need a new phone system for your business, it might be a $50,000 purchase. And you're like, you just get the first quote and it's $50,000 and they have a system and you say, all right, fine, let's do that because I can afford $50,000 in the context of the revenue for the business that the business is currently generating. The risk of that, of course, is that the system might not be a very good system, or the system might be that exact same system might be available for $10,000 less. And of course, you could use that $10,000 better than just, you know, helping out the local telephone provider. So the better you can understand who you are, the better able you're going to be to make decisions.
One of my last questions, Jeff, is, you talk about being in a new season of your life. You've moved to Virginia, so you're not in the day-to-day operations. And you mentioned this near the end of the book. What I want to know from you is, you talk about the succession plan, how every CEO needs to be thinking about, you know, how can I move out of my current position? Am I grooming my successor? Now I want to know, are you teaching your successors how to groom their successors?
Sure. Let me back up just a little bit and talk about why I think that idea of grooming a successor is so important. Is that I see in small and medium-sized businesses that it's really not, for most people, a question of whether you will burn out. It's a question of when that will happen. And so you really need to be prepared for that eventuality, because you never know when it will happen. In my case, it kind of snuck up on me. I put in a lot of effort, a lot of time over the years, that it's taken its toll. And one day I drove into the dealership and I took the key out of the ignition, and it had been a long time that I had really looked forward to going in, and the cumulative toll of all the bad news and the things that didn't work out and all the heartaches associated with building a business had just accumulated. And I couldn't walk in the door. I was just sitting. I was like, it was weird. I mean, it wasn't like my body was incapable of walking. I just couldn't do it. It was like and it was very sudden. And so the importance of grooming your successor is that you're ready at any moment. Maybe it's an accident. Maybe it's a death. That you can make sure that all the fruits of your labor don't get extinguished because you run out of gas, or because you get hurt, or because you're sick, or whatever it is. So So that's what I did. And in my case, I had an operational successor that I had been grooming over many years, someone that really got it and someone that I really admired as a person and I thought could earn the respect of our team. And I just included him in meetings over the years and I'd promoted him to new roles and given him the opportunities to improve his skills and meet new people and develop the networks that he would need. So to answer your direct question, how then do we train this group of team leaders that I have to make sure they're preparing the next one? And a great way to do that is we do annual goals. It's simple. We don't overthink this or overdo it. And for
because
all
you're
of,
a satisficer.
Yeah, well, I'm more so than I used to be anyway. And what we've done is that we put that on their goals every year. You know, what are you doing this year to develop that person? And in Dale's case, you know, he's got a small group of people because it's not always obvious. You don't want to put all your eggs in one basket, or maybe you can't put all your eggs in one basket for one reason or another. It might not be clear who the successor is, but you have two or three people that you want to be developing. And we ask the question, how can we do that? And there, it doesn't have to be anything fancy. Like I said, for us, it was very organic. I wasn't sending Dale off to classes or off to school or anything anywhere. It was just including him and giving him chances to make decisions on his own without me telling him what to do and those kinds of things.
Of course, this is CFO Bookshelf. We ask everybody their favorite books. Now, I cheated, went to your website and found out some of your favorite books, which are, by the way, mentioned in the book. But I'm still going to ask you, what are some of your favorite books? What are some of the books that have had the biggest impact or influence on you? Or what are the books that you gift or recommend to others?
Probably the one I've given the most is Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari. He's a medieval historian, but he wrote just this crazy, unexpected book that summarizes human history in terms of the forces that really drive us and drive the formation of societies. And there's so many great nuanced understandings that he has, but there's the big idea of the book is that we organize our societies around narratives and stories, and that they're very powerful. And this is how we get things done, because any individual cannot build a pyramid in Egypt. But if you can create a structure of people, and maybe that's not the best example because they used enslaved labor to do it. But even let me switch examples then, because I don't even think he uses that example. But one of the ones I use in the book, and I think he uses it in his book, is the idea of money. Is that we don't really think that a piece of paper has any particular value, except that we all agree that it does. And because we agree, we now have a tool, and that's what money is. It's just a way for us to exchange resources in a way that's a lot more practical than lugging around wampum as certain Native American tribes did, or trading gold bars, which would be difficult to fit into your pocket. So I really liked that idea from Sapiens, and I recommend that one. Another book that I really liked is Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow.
Great book.
You might be seeing a pattern here that I like distinctions. I like either ors and all the gray area between them. This idea of the two ways in our psychology that we make decisions. We do some things very automatically without thought. And then, of course, we have the ability to engage the higher reasoning functions of our brain. And those are the difference between the two types, broadly speaking. He does a much better job explaining it than I do. But I learned so much there about just the reliable failures of our own intuition as humans and how we should be alert to the mistakes that we make, why we shouldn't be so confident, why we should be open to looking at decisions as a series of gray options rather than either or binaries. Just lots and lots of great insights about the human condition and indirectly because of that about business in that book.
Speaking of insights, what's next? You've already hit on this a little bit near the beginning, but what's next for you, Jeff?
I think I have something that's somewhat common for entrepreneurs in late middle age. I'm now 49, which is, what do you do with your life after you've done what you set out to do? So I spent so many years just trying to not go out of business, scared to death that we would lose everything that we had worked so hard for. And then I woke up over a period of the last few years and realized we're in pretty good shape there. So I don't need to spend so much time and effort doing that. What am I going to do next? And you can see I'm totally procrastinating through this answer because I have no idea. I know I have a vision of how I want to give back, or that I do want to give back, and I want to share the benefits that have been invested in me by my teachers and previous generations of my family. So many people did so much for me, and it's time for me to share some of that or a lot of that, but I haven't figured it out.
Well, I'm going to give you an idea, but you're going to have to listen to the show itself, because we're going to talk about what I call the entrepreneurial ladder, and you're there. But again, I'm not going to give it away right now. You'll just have to listen. Finally, tell us about your website. Tell us about your website and where else that we can learn about you. Obviously, we're going to point everyone to the book in the show notes. The book is ProfitWise, but you also have a website where you have some information about the book. Anywhere else where we can learn about you, Jeff?
I like, for people who are interested in just sort of the unusual things that we've done in business, we have several businesses, but the one that's probably best known is Planet Subaru. And PlanetSubaru.com illustrates some of the principles that we've discussed here today and in the book. In terms of connecting with me, and I love to hear from readers and listeners, at JeffMorrill.com, my last name's M-O-R-R-I-L-L. There's all sorts of tools there. For example, part of our hiring process, that we use interview scripts for each of the three interviews that our applicants go through. And I have examples of the actual ones we use, so it ties into the book, but you don't even need to read the book to obtain the benefit from the tools that are there. So I invite people to visit JeffMorrill.com.
Jeff, this has been great. Love the book. Thank you for the conversation. And I think we're going to hear your name a little bit more often here in the next year or so.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. And I appreciate the level of attention you gave to the preparation for the podcast. I really enjoyed your questions.
You are listening to CFO Bookshelf, lifelong learning for financial leaders. And now back to our host, Mark Gandy.
Jeff Morrill, author of ProfitWise, thank you very much. Great book, recommend it. A few minutes ago, we talked about the owner's entrepreneurial ladder and what it is in short. And yes, I could probably talk about it for a couple of hours, but think of a ladder leaning against a tall wall. And that ladder has three rungs to it. There's a rung for money, a rung for time, and a rung for meaning. And I believe entrepreneurs, startup founders, they're looking for three things over the course of their business lives. They need or want more money. They need or want more time. And ultimately, I really believe, my heart of hearts, they're looking for more meaning, because they realize there's something more in life than just the business. So again, number one, the need for money. And again, think about it. Every startup founder, not only do they need customers, but they need cash to make payroll, to take care of inventory needs, capital expansion, paying key staff members so they don't leave to go to work for competition or somewhere else. Money is tight those first few years. But at some point in time, they begin to figure it out. Supply demand begins to normalize in the business. And before you know it, they're now being able to pull money out of the business and start generating some personal wealth. Well, once that happens, now there's a whole new need, and that's more time away from the business, because they spent all these years working 60, 70, sometimes more hours. Think of all the ball games that they missed with kids, or being away from a spouse, not being able to spend enough time with that important person, and just other friendships in general. So there comes a point where that person needs more time from the business. Well, at some point in time, they're going to figure that out. And before you know it, they only need to work maybe 25, 30 hours a week. And then what I've found over the years is what they're really looking for is more meaning in their life. That is a very top of the entrepreneurial ladder. And very few owners that I've worked with have actually figured that last need out, more meaning. So again, that is the owner's entrepreneurial ladder. And in my opinion, Jeff, you're going to figure it out. I just know it after listening and visiting with you. Again, this is CFO Bookshelf. I'm Mark Gandy. I cannot wait until next week. We have one of my favorite people, Ed Kless. He's the co-host of The Soul of Enterprise. That's coming up next week on CFO Bookshelf.